What was it? Science didn't know, but dedicated scientists were willing to risk their lives to find out.
This lungfish, the bridge between fish and the land animal. This one was a failure. It hasn't changed in millions of years. But here we have a clue to an answer.
Starring Richard Carlson, grimly adventuring underwater in the depths of the mighty Amazon. Lovely Julia Adams, her beauty allure even to the man-beast from the dawn of time. With Richard Denning, whose scientific passion turned to the fury of revenge. You'll see the most amazing underwater photography that the screen has ever known. In this strangest of all science fiction adventures.
Ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing classic cinema. I'm your host, Kristen Lopez.
And I'm Samantha Ellis.
This episode, we are honoring the anniversary of the 1954 creature feature, Creature from the Black Lagoon. Drea Clark is searching for the Creature from the Black Lagoon. She is not with us, but she is here in spirit. I don't know where she is, actually. Do we know? She said Alabama, correct? Maybe the creature's there.
Sure. Let's go with that.
We are talking all about the 1954 Jack Arnold-directed classic from the Universal Monster canon. I have really no good intro to this. Usually we have a couple minutes of banter. I really have none because this is a movie that really has no introduction. It just exists. Compared to the other Universal monster characters, it's always fun to see what we now know as the Gill Man in the lineup because he just seems so anathema to all the other characters.
All of the other ones have something to do with creation, science fiction, but so far-fetched science fiction that it's like something created by a human or experimented on by a human. And this is really outside of that realm. It's a creature that supposedly exists in this universe, but he wasn't created by anybody. He wasn't some kind of experiment gone wrong. He's just an underwater creature that, by all intents and purposes, could have existed at one point.
I also think there's a distinction in the fact that most of the Universal monster characters are almost all literary.
That's
true. They're all based on a book. Right. So you have Dracula and Frankenstein's monster and Phantom of the Opera, whereas the creature is really his own thing created from whole cloth. I mean, yes, he is inspired by the 1950s just in general, which we'll talk about, but he doesn't have this literary classicism to him. There's nothing sophisticated about him like Jekyll and Hyde. There's something to be said about the subtext of his character, but it's all inherent in the time period and not necessarily the character himself, if that makes sense.
You see the newer adaptations like The Shape of Water, but for the most part, he was very much a product of his time. It wasn't Universal's intention to make this creature become one of the pantheon of classic stars in horror cinema. I think he just sort of became that way on his own because of public interest.
The plot, in a nutshell, before we get too far into deconstructing this movie, you have a geology expedition in the Amazon. They find this fossilized skeletal hand, which, if you were fortunate enough to see this at TCM in 3D, really was impressive. It's from the Devonian period, they say, and supposedly it provides this link between land and sea animals. Dr. Carl Maya, who I always forget is supposed to be a major figure in this movie, he does start us off on the expedition, played by Antonio Moreno. He tells his assistants to stay, and he's going to go to the Marine Biology Institute, where he meets up with a former student who is an ichthyologist, David Reed, played by Richard Carlson. David works at this aquarium, but he has been studying lungfish. David persuades his boss, Dr. Mark Williams, played by Richard Denning, who looks like Richard Carlson. Am I the only one that thought that they were pretty much the same person?
I wouldn't necessarily say they look similar, but they are. You can definitely see it. I mean,
no.
This movie is very much the battle of the two Richards, so I could definitely see that.
One just has lighter hair and is a bit more built than the other one for me. They are exactly the same.
Richard Denning was a bit of a William Holden ripoff.
Very, very much so, yes. And Richard Carlson was just the everyman, almost like a poor man's Dana Andrews. Mark is going to fund this expedition to the Amazon to look for the remainder of this fossilized skeleton. But right after Carl has left this camp, you get the first introduction to the Gill Man. He's curious about this expedition's camp, but he frightens the assistants. They attack him, and he kills them both. Cut to our lovable regular group of people who are going on the ship known as the Rita, captained by Lucas, played by Nestor Paiva, which includes not just David, Carl, and Mark, but also David's girlfriend and colleague. She has a job too. Kay Lawrence, played by Julie Adams, as well as another scientist that nobody really remembers, played by Whit Bissell. That's when you find out that the assistants have been killed and that the Gill Man has taken a liking to Kay. And the rest of the movie from there on out is repetition of Kay finds some reason to get into the water. The Gill Man finds some reason to try to hit on her. She's not having it. At the same time, the two Richards are trying to destroy it.
I will say, I think the two Richards, they have very different opinions on what to do with the creature. And I think that's where a lot of the central conflict of the film comes from. Because Mark Williams, Richard Denning, he is very much a manly man, outdoorsy brute character who wants to bring back the creature by all means necessary, even if that means killing it. Where Richard Carlson is like, we don't have enough information. We don't have the capabilities to catch this thing. We should just go home with what information we have. And he's also a bit of a pacifist. So not only are they fighting over Kay and her affections, they're fighting over what to do about the creature.
There's a lot of discussion about where this movie sits in the grand pantheon of the 1950s. The 1950s was known as this decade of anxiety because we didn't just have nuclear war being held over our heads and the Red Scare and communism, but there was also this concept of consumerism and conformity that was coming as people were moving out of the cities into the suburbs, the creation of the nuclear family as it would be parodied in stuff like Leave It to Beaver and Ozzie and Harriet. But at the same time, you were really seeing this dichotomy between science and the law. And so, like Thing from Another World or It Came from Outer Space, you always had the scientist versus some other power. And in this case, you have Richard Carlson's character, David, who is the quote-unquote good scientist. He's interested in the Gill Man for scientific reasons, to try to fuel this link, to find a way for them to coexist, supposedly. Whereas Richard Denning is just really a capitalist. He wants to profit, experiment, control it in some way. If you've seen The Shape of Water, he's a less disgusting version of the character that Michael Shannon's character is. You're really getting a different look at the 1950s, watching this movie in a time period where movies were very clearly delineated as man's place was on the ground, but they could conquer the stars if they did it the right way. It's fascinating to watch this movie about how there are things on this earth that we don't even know about. And this is a very true statement. I think they've said only like 2% of the oceans have actually been explored.
Absolutely. I think one of the reasons why this film continues to fascinate audiences is because that's still very much a debate that's discussed today. Our oceans still are very undiscovered, and I think it's so cool and interesting, and it probably was very much so at the time, to have this mysterious creature that could be lurking in the depths that we don't know about.
That's what makes this a cut above some of the other sci-fi films of the 50s. I'll be frank, I've seen several of them. Stuff like It Came from Outer Space or Day the World Ended. You and I saw When Worlds Collide.
I was just about to mention that as well. That's a great one. And then you have like other great ones like the Day the Earth Stood Still. But it's just a whole sphere of these sci-fi movies in the 50s that weren't supposed to be so compelling and relevant, but they ended up being incredibly compelling and relevant despite their lack of production value. They had something to say.
I love more of the earthbound creature films that dealt with science. If you enjoy this, you should watch it. It has about 1/10 of the budget, but something like The Monster That Challenged the World. I find that to be a really fun one, even though it's almost a blatant ripoff of this with a very low production value. Creature is a movie that was supposed to be this B movie. William Allen was at this dinner party during Citizen Kane when they were filming it, and he met Gabriel Figueroa, who was this Mexican cinematographer, who told him about this myth of a race of half fish, half human creatures in the Amazon. Allen thought this was incredibly fascinating and wrote a bunch of notes entitled The Sea Monster and held on to it. He wanted to make a Beauty and the Beast-esque love story. I chuckle just thinking about how dumb it sounds, where a beautiful woman falls in love with this fish man, which you can see where Guillermo del Toro took his inspiration from. They asked for a treatment of it, and I'm reading Mallory O'Meara's book, The Woman from the Black Lagoon, all about Millicent Patrick, who actually designed the creature. She writes in that book that the development of this movie was very fraught with issues because Allen wanted this self-serious Beauty and the Beast love story, and Universal's people couldn't really make that work. They expanded it. Maurice Zim turned it into a treatment. Harry Essex and Arthur Ross rewrote it as this creature feature called The Black Lagoon. And it was always supposed to be this B movie. You can supposedly read the original treatment that William Allen and Maurice Zim put together, but it was this supposedly very dumb movie. It was really Essex and Ross who rewrote it into the movie that it is today. But that Beauty and the Beast element is still there-ish.
I think at the very least, in a sense, for example, Guillermo del Toro's take on it, if it couldn't outright display that kind of a relationship on screen, it made us want that kind of a relationship from what they showed us.
The Shape of Water is a movie that I find very fascinating, and
I love it. I'm actually a big fan, for sure.
It's really interesting to deconstruct. But in this movie specifically, it's hard not to see the allure of not necessarily the creature, because when you're stuck with the stuff that they had, Millicent Patrick's work in this movie is utterly amazing. The creature design is great. But as you watch the sequels and they kept changing the design a little bit, the creature just never looks particularly inviting. But what I really appreciate about this movie is that Kay is really posited as this love object for the two Richards, as I'm going to keep calling them. They're so content to keep her on this boat while at the same time just totally grousing to each other that you can understand why she would want to escape that.
Absolutely. She didn't really have good options in the first place. And I think that's one of the main reasons why you could see her being with such a creature that's full of heart. There's a personality there, almost more so than the Richards.
There is. I have to say, I think a lot of what people find attractive and when they think about this romantic entanglement between Kay and the creature is through the swimming sequences. As somebody who loves swimming sequences, if you've listened to me talk about Esther Williams, I love how they shoot the underwater footage in this film. It's graceful. It's balletic. If you are curious about why Kay and the creature have this bond, you just have to watch Julie Adams and Riku Browning, who did the swimming sequences as the creature, as they swim through the Universal Pond. They're in unison. There's this give and take to them. As much as she doesn't know that he's beneath her, there is this unity to their movement as if they are destined, as if they are able to anticipate each other's moves. And that's very romantic, even without them touching.
There are so many memorable shots here. That's the thing. Like I said, why I believe that this movie is so well remembered, because it may not have been anticipated to be such a success and remembered so fondly today, but there's still a whole lot of talent here with the cinematography and the choreography of those sequences and the acting and the design. It's all really stellar.
It really shows how proximity can be enticing. Kay is literally close to David and Mark throughout this entire movie, physically close to them. And it's always aggressive. There's always this dominance between how they handle her versus how the creature handles her.
The real focus whenever the three of them were in a scene were between the two Richards. Kay was always sort of shoved off to the side. Even the person that she's supposedly with and wanting to be engaged to, there's no chemistry there. And I feel like that relationship is treated entirely different than her relationship with the creature. As far as the script goes, she might not have been wanting the creature back, but I mean, she was terrified of him. But you could honestly argue that there's more chemistry there, easily.
It's been a while since I've brought it up, but Mallory O'Meara's book made me think of it, so I have to say it. Homoeroticism. I know, I'm sorry. I had to
I mean, really, honestly.
There is so much homoeroticism in this movie, particularly between the two Richards. Kay really does fit into the definition of what is known as the homoerotic buffer, which is the woman that both men are interested in because they're really interested in each other. So you have that, but at the same time, the fact that they're in competition for who is smarter, the fact that they do look the same almost, there is this weird vain narcissism to the two of them, even though Richard Carlson's character is supposed to be more sympathetic. I really noticed that. And at the same time, Mallory O'Meara made me think of this, and I know we had talked about it when we talked about Gentlemen Prefer Blondes really briefly. Aside from the characters, the human characters, calling him the Gill Man, what makes him a man?
He has a bit of a figure. He's got two legs and two arms, but...
Right, and so I went literally down this weird rabbit hole where I was sitting there thinking, the Gill Man has been commissioned as a man as far as the people writing the scripts, but there's really nothing to denote that he is physically male or female or any gender.
That's true.
My thing while watching this movie this recent time is, how do we know that the Gill Man is not a Gill Woman, and that maybe what Kay is into, the fact that he is a different species, maybe it's a little same-sex type of reading here. I could be completely off-base.
I don't know if they necessarily intended that way, but I think that you could definitely make an argument for it. I see what you're saying. Like, she's sort of surrounded by...
so much machismo.
Right. All the testosterone, and then looking outwards to something different. I see what you're saying. I can see that. I mean, I think the chemistry between the two Richards, no matter what kind of chemistry it is, I think it's more and more glaringly obvious the more times you watch it. Because, of course, the first time you watch this movie, you're not even going to pay attention to much of the human action going on. You're looking for the creature around every corner. I've seen this movie a million times. I have a huge devoted connection to it. It's really my favorite Universal film. The more times you watch it, it's so apparent that there's something going on between these two guys.
And conversely, you could even read it even further if you don't want to go with that route, which is the fact that the two men are just obsessed with this Gill Man.
That's true.
Maybe it's not even about Kay, and maybe they just want the Gill Man for themselves, and they're arguing over it. You could go cross-eyed with how many different queer theories you could throw at this movie. That's what's fascinating. We talked about Jekyll and Hyde. I've talked on this show with other guests about Frankenstein and even Dracula to an extent. You get maybe classism, you get maybe foreignness or racism. Creature, I think, really lends itself to being open to nearly any interpretation.
That's one of the best parts about it, too. I would agree with that. On the outside, it's such a cut and dry love story this guy good, this guy bad, Gilman bad. There's a lot more to it than that when you actually read into it.
When we have to talk about the creature himself, the Gilman suit, you should really check out Woman from the Black Lagoon if you want a decent overview of Millicent Patrick, who was the woman that was responsible for creating the Gilman. There is some contention about this, and Mallory O'Meara explains it perfectly in her book, that there is a lot of back and forth, particularly from men, that Millicent Patrick did not design the creature, that she just was someone's girlfriend, and she was credited for that for diversity purposes. And that is untrue. Millicent Patrick did design it. The Gilman costume was originally posited as being said it looked like the Oscar statuette. It was just a unitard with some big fake feet and claws and a head. They didn't like that. They ended up using a lot of foam rubber with a latex skin. They had two actors. You had Ben Chapman, who was the creature on land. You had Riku Browning, who was the creature in the water. And of course, they had a hell of a time actually navigating the suit. There were issues with being unable to see and having to hold their breath. You can really tell, too, as the sequels developed, the changes that they made to try to make the suit more comfortable. In certain scenes, especially on a big screen, you can tell that there are no holes in the eyes. Especially during close-ups of the creature, you can tell where the eye holes are, which I thought was hilarious. Millicent Patrick is the one who made the creature what the creature looks like in the first film. The sexism that she had to deal with and her eventual firing from Universal is a real shame, considering how few women there were in the visual effects field. The creature is probably the most complex of all the Universal monsters that we know.
I actually personally have a huge interest in aquatics and fish. I have my own fish. The design and the gills and just the sheer detail on the creature is something that I love too. And I think the marine aspect is something that really draws me in the first place. I have a lot of personal attachment to this film and the design. I think the design is just fantastic. I love how the eyes, yes, there's not really a whole lot going on behind them because they couldn't animate the eyes in any way, but I love that it's so obvious that they're just these blown glass orbs and there's just so much going on in them. They're just beautiful. It's a really beautiful design. I mean, Riku Browning, he couldn't even breathe underwater as the creature, as you mentioned. I've never seen the sequels. From what I've heard, you can see bubbles emitting from the top of the head of all places.
That is very true. The creature costumes in the sequels start to look cheaper as the films progress, which is really upsetting, leading to the third film, which there's a big issue I have with the third movie from a race perspective, which we can talk about the sequels in a second, but this movie is the gold standard for the creature suit.
I have to appreciate the fact that they were more able to sacrifice utility for art. It's just a beautiful, artful film and design and costume. And Millicent Patrick, I mean, she did fantastic work. I didn't even know that she was responsible for that until recently, until this book.
Millicent Patrick is a name that should be on people's lips more. And it's great that there's actually opportunity now to talk about her as a what we now know as VFX artist and makeup artist. It's great that her story is finally being told, but it's upsetting that sexism pretty much ruined her career in the industry.
For all intents and purposes, you could say that at this point in film history, Universal was just a cut above Poverty Row as far as studios went. Creature from the Black Lagoon and all of these successes responsible by incredible women like Millicent Patrick and Edith Head later for some of those 50s Hitchcock films, they're responsible for the clout that Universal received as a studio.
And it's important to look at where Universal had started out with these opulent literary-based movies in the 30s and the 40s. And then by the 50s, they really struggled to figure out what people were doing, which is why this movie has 3D. 1953 was the year of 3D. This when 3D had tapered off. Nearly everything in 53 was in 3D, but by 54, you weren't getting it nearly as much. You and I were fortunate to see this in 3D at TCM. What was it, 2 years ago?
Yes, it wasn't this year, but last year, the 2018 festival.
And I can say that Universal's restoration, I wish I had a 3D TV because utterly amazing. It was the best 3D movie I've ever seen in my entire life.
Not only that, like I said, I have a huge connection to this film, and it was by far the best viewing. The first time that I watched it, it was in my living room on Halloween, and I was watching it with my boyfriend and my sister, and they both fell asleep immediately. But I just sat up in my seat absolutely enraptured by this film. It means the world to me, and being able to see it on the big screen in 3D, the hand, I think, was the moment. Everybody gasped in the theater, and seeing the beautiful waves and the fish swimming right in front of you, it's just so incredible. Few festivals still kind of run that 3D print around. I know this isn't the only one. I know that there was a convention that I went to last year. I didn't get to see it there, but they had this print introduced in 3D by Rico Browning, who I got to meet him at the convention, but I didn't get to see the print. The TCM Film Festival, I mean, it was something to remember for sure.
It's rare to find a 3D film that makes you truly believe something is in the theater with you. This transfer, especially when that hand comes out, you definitely believe it's in the room. It might not be in front of your eyeballs, but you're believing that it is actually coming out of the screen.
I like lurched backward in that moment. That was my favorite moment in the whole film as far as the 3D aspect. That was so well done. I mean, everybody was like, what?
When you bring up your connections to this movie, we haven't talked in depth about Julie Adams. You've mentioned it before, but you had a moment with Julie Adams in a way.
I did. I reached out to her. I wrote to her because she's, in my opinion, right up there with Elsa Lanchester as the best Universal monster woman. I'm a big fan, and I reached out to her and I asked her for her autograph, and she was just such a kind lady. She responded. We messaged back and forth on Facebook a few times. She sent me not one, but two pictures. It was so sweet. I asked her to sign one and she sent me two back. Her son, Mitchell Danton, was and is so involved in her memory, and it just broke my heart when I heard that she passed away. I love her movies. In addition to this, Bend of the River, I just watched the Mississippi Gambler with Tyrone Power, and she was so cute in that. She's just an exceptional actress and just a wonderful person. And I got to meet Rico Browning as well, like I mentioned. I met him last year at a convention. I almost got his autograph, but it's one of those situations. I was $1 short. I was so upset. But I got to talk to him, and that was really cool, too. This movie has touched my life at so many different parts. I mean, I discovered it on Halloween. And for my 21st birthday, I almost went to Wakulla Springs in Florida, where the underwater scenes were filmed. I was going to stay there in their hotel and be around all that old Hollywood history, but this huge hurricane swept the state the day before my birthday and the day before I was supposed to go, and they shut their doors. They completely closed, so we weren't able to go. But I'm definitely going back one day for sure.
I love your classic film stories. I don't have nearly those fun experiences, so I live vicariously through you.
Oh, Julie Adams, that's one of the ones that's gonna mean a lot to me for a long time. I love her. I'm a huge, huge fan. And Rico Browning is such a sweetheart, too. I mean, he's still so involved. I have a bit of a connection to him because he got this role as the creature while he was in college in Florida studying film. I'm like, wow, I literally lived in Florida and am studying film. So it's like, maybe I can be the underwater guy for the creature of the Black Lagoon someday. Who knows?
We talk about Julie Adams. Her character is really the best middle ground for these movies because the female characters in these sequels, as they would continue, tended to fall into extremes after a point. In 1955, you got the first sequel, Revenge of the Creature, also directed by Jack Arnold. It involves the creature being transported to this aquarium in southern Florida. Once again, he falls for a scientist, and all hell breaks loose when he escapes. The movie really redoes the first movie, only now we're not in the Amazon, we're in a theme park. I'm assuming this is where the plot of Jaws 3 or whatever, the one that was set in the theme park, came from. The female character here, Helen, played by Laurie Nelson, is a real step back from Kay Lawrence, because where Kay was intelligent, yes, she might have gotten into a few scrapes of her own making, Laurie Nelson's character is just the girl. She just wants to be the guy to get John Agar, get him his slippers and his pipe at the end of the day. And she has no real talent. I think they mentioned she's like a journalist, but she's like, oh, I'm not really into anything. It's all a front. She's not really that smart.
I know exactly what you're talking about. First, the one that comes to my mind is Debbie Reynolds in The Tender Trap. Oh, I have this career that I'm pursuing, but it doesn't really mean anything to me. I just want a husband.
I just need something to fill my day with while I get my MRS degree.
Exactly.
And then at the same time, you have the opposite. You have Lee Snowden's character, Marcia Barton, in the next sequel, which is The Creature Walks Among Us, not directed by Jack Arnold, directed by John Sherwood. I actually think Creature Walks Among Us is the only sequel you really need to watch. It's a really weird domestic melodrama with a creature from the Black Lagoon movie in here. So you have the attempt to turn the Gill Man into an air breather. They do some sort of mumbo jumbo where he might end up being a half man, half creature, but I have real issues with it because the makeup effects that they use as he's transitioning into a human make him look like a African-American caricature. He's got the big lips, and there's actually been a lot of writing done on the not so subtle racism of this movie and the civilizing of this inferior species.
I had no idea. Oh my goodness, that sounds very cringeworthy.
It's really shocking to just see the creature and how stereotypical it looks. But at the same time, you have these two, again, competing scientists, one of whom is crazy and is in this relationship with a woman, Marcia, played by Lee Snowden, who is this gun-toting badass lady who's just like, I got a bathing suit. I'll jump in the water. I'll do it. I don't care. She is just utterly reckless and fearless. The white suit has to be an homage to the original, where Kay is all Absolutely. Grace and elegance. Marcia Barton is just fire and a punch to the face. And I actually really enjoy her in this movie.
Which is the one with Clint Eastwood?
Clint Eastwood is in The Revenge of the Creature.
Oh my goodness.
So it's a very small role. He sticks out like a Clint Eastwood, and he is there reading some weird science malarkey that I'm not believing he knows anything about.
Would any of us ever believe that he was a scientist?
Sequels aren't really, really good, but I will say I recommend The Creature Walks Among Us. Jack Arnold was best known as a director of science fiction features. He directed a lot of them going into the 50s specifically. He did, obviously, Revenge of the Creature in this film. He did 1953's It Came from Outer Space. He did 1955's Tarantula, The Incredible Shrinking Man. So he did quite a bunch of them. And then at the same time, he did these low-budget, know-nothing movies like 1958's High School Confidential before he transitioned into predominantly television as the 50s through the 60s would continue. He was very famous in TV. If you watch any television show from 1957 to about 1970, you probably saw one of his episodes.
I was familiar with him for sure before I found out each of the films that he made. I knew the name as soon as I saw it in the credits. Before the script was finished, plans had already been made to leave the creature's fate uncertain at the end of the picture in order to leave an opening for the sequel. And I thought that was really interesting. I don't know if they could have anticipated the level of hype and acclaim that this movie would receive, but I thought that was fascinating.
What's hilarious is you watch these sequels and they really have no through line between any of them at all.
Nope. Creature from the Black Lagoon, the first one, it received really positive reviews from critics upon its release too, and it earned $1.3 million at the box office. The narrative that this movie was one of many B films in the 50s and then went on to become a classic isn't quite true just from those statistics. I think it's a little bit of both. There were a lot of sci-fi films from the 50s that meant a lot to a lot of people.
What's fascinating is that this movie has withstood the test of time. It is in Universal's canon.
It's one of those things that could still very much happen.
The Gillman has become one of the Universal monsters, quote unquote. He is in the pantheon, even though he is the campiest of them all. And I think a lot of that has to do with Jack Arnold's seriousness on this movie and how otherworldly it looked. We talked about Jekyll and Hyde, the Friedrich March one. There is this classiness to it, this elegance that is a bit cold and indifferent. Something like Frankenstein or Dracula, you know, those characters overshadow all of the human characters and really overshadow the movie. Their largesse is what makes the film compelling. Right. Whereas with the Gillman, you need him in that movie and that movie needs him.
Julie Adams herself was quoted as saying when she was explaining her reasoning for why she thinks the film stands the test of time, she said, "There's always that feeling of compassion for the monster. I think maybe it touches something in ourselves, maybe the darker parts of ourselves that longs to be loved and think they really can't ever be loved. It strikes a chord within us." And that's another aspect of the film and its success.
And they've tried desperately to revive this franchise as much as they can. I know 1982, John Landis wanted Jack Arnold to direct a remake of the film. They wrote a script. It was essentially going to be a Jekyll and Hyde meets the Gillman story, where you had two creatures. One was destructive and the other one was a nice guy who was being persecuted. Yeah. Oh, and they were going to do it in 3D, and Universal canceled it because of budgetary concerns and because they already had a movie involving a killer swimming thing in 3D. Once again, Jaws 3D comes back to rear its ugly head. And then John Carpenter was actually developing a remake in 92 at Universal. They had a script. The famous Rick Baker was going to create a 3D model of the creature, but it never got greenlit. And numerous people have written scripts hoping to remake it. At one point, Peter Jackson was offered a director's position for this in 1995, but he decided to work on his long gestating King Kong remake instead. And then in 96, you had Ivan Reitman, who wanted to direct a remake, and that never happened. Once The Mummy did really well in 99, Universal started to revive those talks. So in December of 2001, you had Gary Ross, who was going to write and produce a remake with his father, who was Arthur Ross, one of the original writers of this film, which I just realized 10 seconds ago. And Gary Ross said, quote, "The story that my father wrote embodies the clash between primitive men and civilized men." And that obviously makes it a fertile area for reexamination. But of course, we all know that didn't happen. Even though they had Guillermo del Toro attached as the director, he wanted to do a story more on the creature's perspective and let him get the girl at the end. We all know that Universal said no, and we all know that he went on to win an Oscar making that same movie, which was called The Shape of Water, which is hilarious that they turned that down. But Universal kept trying. In 2005, they hired Breck Eisner to direct it. And they were going to reinvent the origins of the Gillman. He was going to be kind of like the Toxic Avenger, part of this pharmaceutical corporation polluting the Amazon.
Okay.
That movie was going to happen, but they delayed it because of the writer's strike that happened in 07. Breck Eisner went on to do another remake called The Crazies. And then he was supposed to come back and finish this in Brazil. They were going to film it in Brazil and the actual Amazon River in Peru. They were actually going to leave the Universal lot where they filmed the first movie and do it in actual.
Oh, that sounds amazing, though, I have to say.
Yeah, supposedly Eisner was the farthest into production. He had the locations, and the boat had been built, the redone Rita.
Wow.
And it was supposed to be this huge summer blockbuster. He spent 6 months working on the design of the Gillman with Mark McCreary, who had worked on Jurassic Park. It was supposed to be very faithful to the original. The Gillman was going to be incredibly sympathetic development hell happened. 2009 showed up.
Oh,
and we just never heard about Breck Eisner's version. March of 2012, Universal announced that another remake was going to happen. It would simply be called The Black Lagoon, the original title that this movie had started out with, because they didn't want it to necessarily be a sequel or a remake. It was going to be its own thing. They had hired a screenwriter. It was supposed to happen for a 2014 release date, but it ended up being canceled. So we've had numerous, numerous remakes. And if you're saying, Kristen, what about the Dark Universe? Universal's massive attempt to redo all of their Universal monster movies. Creature was not really considered. Obviously, we know it began with The Mummy, the 2017 version with Tom Cruise. It was going to continue with Bride of Frankenstein. The Creature from the Black Lagoon did have a script written by Will Beale. As of right now, we know that the screenwriters have left the project, and the failure of the Dark Universe has pretty much fallen apart. I doubt we'll be seeing a Creature remake at this point.
Not at this point, but I genuinely, genuinely believe that there will be a remake at some point. It's impossible not to remake.
I'm sure there will be. It's always going to be hard, especially now that The Shape of Water does exist.
If anything, that was more of a proof of concept. And it wasn't an outright remake. Universal could move forward with something that is an outright remake because of the success of Shape of Water. Obviously, that proved that modern audiences are still very fascinated by this story.
But at the same time, it's always going to look like an also-ran.
That's true.
I don't think either of us is wrong. I'm sure eventually in like 30 years, we'll probably get Channing Tatum to play the Gilman. I don't know.
Channing Tatum, he's going to be getting up there in years at that point.
I don't know. The hot young Ansel Elgort or somebody, Timothy Chalamet, is going to play the Gilman at some point. I don't know.
Love it.
But it could very well happen.
Well, before we close out, I do have to mention, I know you very passively mentioned Whit Bissell earlier. In fact, I have to admit, I don't even know what his character's name is either. But I have the hots for him a little bit. I admit he's one of those really weird out of left field crushes that I have. And I think even though he plays a really small part in this movie, he's really cute. And I would take him over either Richard any day.
Whit Bissell plays Dr. Edwin Thompson. Yeah, I don't remember him either.
I know that he is attacked by the creature at one point, and half the movie he's in bed covered in bandages from head to toe.
Actually, if this was Anaconda, he'd be the Eric Stoltz of this movie.
There you go. You always have to have somebody be a victim of the creature before the main characters are. He was the test dummy. Julie Adams, she was graceful and beautiful, but she could hold her own. I mean, she did all of her own stunts for this film. Something could be said of that for sure.
Proof of her awesomeness, and that she didn't need the two Richards for this movie.
She didn't need anybody. She didn't even need the creature, but we all wanted her to be with the creature.
I
think that's the summary of this whole thing. The two Richards were dicks. She should have been with the creature. She was independent enough to be without him, too.
I'm thinking the creature just wants to be friends with these people, and they're like trying really hard to force him into a relationship, and he does not want any of them.
That situation where he just wants a hug, yeah, is that what
exactly. Like, hey, I was just gonna like hang out with you guys, and you guys are all thinking that I should marry you, and I'm just not down for that. And then they spend the entire movie trying to force him into a relationship. I mean, if you really think about it, you're watching the two Richards roll around under the water with the creature. Are they assaulting him? It looks like it. I'm just saying.
They're getting all up in his business. That's all I'll say.
I'm just saying, please do not send me angry emails. Overall thoughts, I think Creature is a really fun film. Out of all of the movies, that horror movies, especially sci-fi films of the 50s, it's a must. The
absolutely
best made, I think, out of all of them. Beautiful underwater photography. Millicent Patrick's creature designs are great. It's one you got to see. You have to experience it. It's unlike anything else Universal put out.
For lack of a better phrase, I'm very much in the same boat as you, Kristen. I would say that this is definitely one of the best ventures that Universal ever put forth. It's a fantastic film. I think it's a great one to watch on Halloween, but really any day of the year is a day where you can appreciate Creature from the Black Lagoon. I think it's just a magical film. All of the performances are really something to appreciate, something to marvel. And really, I love it for the same reasons that you do. The underwater cinematography, the design, Julie Adams especially. I think it's just a fantastic movie.
Send us your thoughts on all the Creature from the Black Lagoon movies, whether you think it's homoerotic or not. You can send them to us at ticklishbiz@gmail.com and we'll read them on the next episode. Sam, before we do all the housekeeping, where can fans find and get in touch with you online?
I am blogging at musingsofaclassicfilmaddict.com. You can read my Cooking with the Stars posts at classicmoviehub.com, and I'm on Twitter at classicfilmgeek.
You can find me on Twitter at journeys_film, and that's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to the show a variety of different ways, either at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio and Player FM, or on iTunes. If you're listening via iTunes, please help us out and leave us a rating and review. We are also on Spotify, and we are now on SoundCloud. You can contact us directly with your questions, comments, suggestions at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z @gmail.com, and you can visit me at my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. If you want to learn more about upcoming episodes, get exclusive merchandise, or hear content before anyone else, then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. We have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the classic film podcast that it is. If you become a patron right now, you get the opportunity to listen to these episodes a whole 2 days early. You get access to all of my interviews. I have an interview coming up with Jen Ponton. We have Ticklish Business pins that you can get. You also are going to be having access to my two supplementary shows, which we have the schedules down for. Woohoo! I do Based on a True Podcast with William Bibbiani and Doubled Features with Adam Kautzer. All of that is over at patreon.com/ticklishbiz. And if you want to learn about the stars turning 100 in 2019, we aren't talking about it on the show, but if you're a member of TCM's exclusive fan club, TCM Backlot, you can read my year-long series about the stars spotlighted show this month. We are talking about Robert Stack. She's really fun. I'm excited to write it.
Gorgeous, I have to say.
Yes, Robert Stack's a very convoluted figure in my life, and I love it so much. Next time, I'm pretty sure Drea will be back, celebrating John Wayne's birthday, talking about his complicated legacy, and talking about another 1939 staple, John Ford's Stagecoach. You have never seen it.
I haven't. I'm so excited. It was one that I've been eager to see since Filmstruck, and I didn't get the chance to see it while Filmstruck was around. Now, I mean, I'm getting really into Westerns again. I saw my first Roy Rogers movie last month. I'm so thrilled to see this for the first time and talk about it with you guys.
Perfect. Well, that'll be next episode. Till then.